friends, I'm very happy to be in Dublin as a guest of the Peace and Neutrality Alliance. Happy also that we tried to start this meeting on time. From my previous experiences in Ireland, meetings usually start an hour late. So some things have moved on. Three years ago, millions of people assembled on the streets of Europe and North America to try and stop the Iraq war from taking place. And it's worth just looking back on that. The scale of those demonstrations was unprecedented in global history. You had nearly 2 million people in London, 2.5 million people in Madrid. Hi, guys, you can sit in the front, don't be shy. Because I've noticed sitting here that people come in and go to the back, but there are seats in here, so. And it won't stop you from leaving if you get bored, so you can still sit. There were demonstrations on a scale which we had not witnessed before. And it's important to remember that these demonstrations took place in the United States as well. In New York City, which had been the target of terrorist attacks on 9/11, you had 1 million people marching against the war on Iraq. Just under 1 million people marched in Los Angeles. Under 1 million marched in San Francisco in the Bay Area. If you look at it, it was quite a phenomenal event. And it's worth just looking back on that to see what happened to that movement. And there were 100,000 in Dublin, which proportionately for the population of the city is a fantastically large demonstration. So it was a global thing. Now, what happened to that movement? It's foolish to pretend that that particular movement just carried on. It didn't. The overwhelming majority of the people who came out onto the streets 3 years ago to stop the war were people with very little tradition of left politics, of pacifist politics, of campaigning politics. They were, in their majority, ordinary citizens who imagined that by coming out, they might actually stop the politicians in their tracks. And when they couldn't, they got disillusioned. That's the way the world works at the moment. And they went back home, not supporters of the war, but demoralized, bitter, cynical, angry. And small groups of people, relatively speaking, carried on with the anti-war movement, which goes up and which goes down, but which has never managed to achieve that pinnacle which it did before the war began. But that doesn't mean that those of us who are more aware, let's be blunt about it, of the state of the world, and who know what's going on, should stay silent or should not speak up. And one of the interesting things that's been happening in the United States, a country which I visit a great deal, is that the military families against the war have begun to play a central part in the anti-war movement. The name of Cindy Sheehan has become well known all over the world because she, as a mother of a child who died in the war in Iraq, took a stand on her own outside Bush's ranch in Texas and became a symbol of that movement. And that had a massive impact in the United States. It's also made people understand that those who were opposed to the war weren't just tiny groups of people, but that a large chunk of the population was opposed to it. So the anti-war movement, as a result of that, is on the rise again. In Britain, we've had military families campaigning against the war incredibly effectively. Those of you who saw the last general election results on television, the British general election results, may have noticed Blair looking incredibly queasy and shifty as one of the candidates who stood against him, Reg Keyes, who lost a son in the war, stood up and said to Blair's face what he thought of him. That had a big impact. It's one of the high points of the last election campaign or election results in Britain. So there are lots of subterranean movements against the war, and it's time to try and unite them again because we're in quite a critical situation in the Arab world. What is this situation? The situation can be summed up as follows. Having failed to secure Iraq, the United States is tempted to distract attention from their failures in Iraq by lightning military strikes against neighboring countries. And so Iran has currently become a target, with 57% of the American population, which is opposed to the war on Iraq, saying that it would favor a lightning raid to destroy Iran's nuclear facility. It shows the level and degree of confusion that exists. So if the United States does that, and it's still a very big if, for the following reasons. Because what has happened in Iraq over the last 3 years is what usually happens when there is a colonial occupation of a country. That the only way a colonizing power, an imperial power, can hold on to a colonized, occupied country is by exacerbating and sharpening ethnic, religious, sectarian divisions. That is the history of colonization. It's a history of how the British Empire used to operate in India, in Ireland, in Africa, wherever, in Cyprus, effects of which are still with us today. And the American Empire is now operating in the same way in Iraq. So essentially, the country de facto is divided into three parts. There's the Kurdish areas in the north of Iraq, where the tribal leaders who've taken money from every power under the sun for the last 25, 30 years are now saying quite openly that they want an independent Kurdistan. But an independent Kurdistan in today's context would be nothing more or less than an Israeli-American protectorate. That's what it would be. The notion that any of these tiny states could be independent is just a joke. It's laughable. Then you have a large swathe of southern Iraq, which they talk about as Shia Iraq, which is pro-Iranian. And the political parties there are very close to the Iranians. Then you have middle Iraq, where basically they're trying to find a suitable puppet from the former regime who can take over middle Iraq, and then they will try and do some sort of a deal with them. That is what is really going on. But this poses problems for the following reasons. That the only reason the occupation has lasted so long, and incidentally, the Americans were not prepared for and not expecting a massive resistance, but this resistance erupted in Iraq. And this resistance is not, as the bulk of the Western media likes to point out, some nutty little group linked to Al-Qaeda led by al-Zarqawi. If it was just that, it would have been wiped out ages ago. The resistance in Iraq, in central Iraq, is essentially large sections. Now the Americans give the figure. They say they don't even call them, interestingly enough, because they know they might have to deal with them. They don't describe the mainstream resistance as terrorists. They describe them as insurgents, because they know they will have to deal with them sooner or later. And essentially, what the resistance in Iraq consists of is many, many units of the former Iraqi army who, realizing that Saddam Hussein was incapable of defending the country, and quite a few of them being disgusted with him and what he'd done, decided 1 month before the United States went in to break up into small units, decentralize large layers of the army, send them back to their territories from where they came, their home villages, build armed dumps throughout the country which could be used in an attritional war, a classical guerrilla warfare against an occupying power, and said, we will make this country ungovernable as long as it is occupied by Western powers. And that is essentially what they have succeeded in doing. So that to this day, 3 years later, within the so-called green zone, which is meant to be the safest zone in Baghdad, there is still no security. The only thing standing between a total defeat and humiliation for the United States is the Shia parties. If they had not collaborated, and this is where we come to the ironies of the situation, the Iranian clerics running that country decided for their own narrow reasons to give tacit support to the occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan. That is why this later saber-rattling against Iran is partially tragic but partially comical. Because about a year ago I was in the Gulf States giving a lecture and I spoke to senior figures there. Because that's when the saber-rattling against Iran had started. And they told me that the Iranian vice president had visited the Gulf states, and they had asked him, are you worried by what the Americans are saying? And they said, astonishingly enough, the Iranian vice president burst out laughing. So they said, why are you laughing? He said, I'm laughing because the Americans know and we know that without our support they couldn't hold Iraq. If they decide to bomb us, we will fight them not in Iran but in Iraq, and we will destroy their armed forces. And I think that is not just boasting. Because if the Shia militias, who are heavily armed, by the way, inside Iraq, were to be let loose, the British Army would have to withdraw very quickly. In fact, about 8 months ago, a senior British officer in Basra said, if we are suddenly one day we see 200,000 people marching in our direction, he said, I will not give the orders to open fire because that would then be a time to pack our bags and go home. We never heard from him again. But the fact that a senior British officer felt obliged to say that is of some interest, which means that they know what the stakes are. And the stakes are that hang on to the Shia parties for all that it's worth, which is why the saber-rattling against Iran does not make sense at all as anything but saber-rattling. I'm not saying that the Bush administration is not capable of authorizing a lightning strike against the nuclear reactor or encouraging the Israelis to do it, as they've done before. It could happen, but it's a very risky enterprise and it's a very risky operation, because once they do that, the Iranians will pull the plug on the occupation in Iraq. Without any doubt, they more or less said it. More or less said it. And then there will be a big humiliation, or they could escalate the war and decide to use nuclear weapons. That's the only way they could stop it, by killing 500,000 or 1 million Iraqis in massive strikes. But I think public opinion in the Western countries would probably not wear that. I think there would be a massive outcry and governments would fall if that happened. But those are the two options. So I'm just saying, be careful. Don't be carried away by the saber rattling and assume that Iran is going to be invaded. It could be bombed. It's possible. But for the reasons I'm pointing out, it would be totally counterproductive. In terms of a military occupation of Iran, that is physically impossible. And the reason it's physically impossible is they don't have enough troops. And the reason they don't have enough troops is because all the reserves have dried up. No one's volunteering to join the American army. So much so that there's been a massive increase in recruiting mercenaries from Central America, from Nicaragua, from Guatemala. And they are unemployed kids who the Americans are recruiting, and they're being offered $20,000 when they join to go and fight in Iraq, an annual salary of $25,000, and after they fought for 3 years, they're given a written guarantee they will be given U.S. citizenship, if they survive, of course. That is what they've been compelled to do because they don't have enough people on the ground. And if they don't have enough people on the ground to fight the war in Iraq, they cannot do it in Iran or Syria or any other country in the Middle East, because imperial powers with heavy air power, like the United States of America, can go and knock out any country from the air, but when it comes to occupying countries, you need troops. And if you don't have enough troops of your own, you need troops of client states. But client states from the region, in the case of Iraq, have absolutely refused to collaborate. There are no troops from any Arab country in Iraq. There are troops from the EU. There's the British Army, as you know. And then there are troops from Denmark. There are Danish troops there. There are Ukrainian troops there. There are Polish troops there. Though they're under they're Italian troops there, under heavy pressure to pull out. And most of the countries are saying that they will start a withdrawal by the fall this year. So it's not that they are present in large numbers. They're essentially there, apart from the Brits, to give the United States psychological support. There are a few Japanese there, too, who say they're not there to fight, but just to be there. So it's interesting. And, I mean, the one advantage from that might be that a few Japanese restaurants might open up in Bandar. But apart from that, it's a pretty bleak situation for the United States. They are heavily dependent on what is going on inside the Shia organization. So be very cautious before saying they're going to declare war on Iraq. I mean, if they do, they will suffer very greatly. And so it's not at all an open question. The second big area in the Middle East where you have now growing problems for them is Palestine. With the election of Hamas, in fact, the sensational electoral victory of Hamas in Palestine, there's a big crisis now. And, you know, it's important to try and understand why Hamas won. You know, prior to the victory, prior to the elections in Palestine, 70 American senators went public and issued a statement saying that the United States should prevent a Hamas victory, cancel the elections, not allow them to be held, stop all this. But no one thought, including Mossad, the Israeli intelligence agency, none of them thought that the victory would be so big and so huge. They thought Hamas would make gains, but Hamas swept the polls. And it's important to be clear on why they won. And if you read what their own leaders say, they say we didn't win because the Palestinians suddenly decided that the Holy Quran was the most important thing in the world. We won because we're the only group in Palestine which is opposed to the Oslo Accords, which is opposed to collaboration with Israel and the United States, which feels we've got nowhere after all this collaboration over the last so many years, and we are fed up with the Israelis, with the Americans, with their PLO collaborators, and we are fed up with the level and degree of corruption inside the Palestinian Authority itself, who've largely been feathering their own nests and have done very little for the Palestinian people as a whole. That was the election message of Hamas. And that is what brought 78% of the electorate. Much higher figure now than in the United States, certainly higher than Britain and some European countries as well, of people who came out to vote. What happens once the vote is cast? Shock, horror! Because democracy these days is only permissible if it takes place within certain carefully established limits. Either party A or party B, Tweedledum or Tweedledee wins. Both parties agree with each other on the principal issues of the day, socially, economically, ideologically, in terms of foreign policy, so it's fine. But where democracy becomes an actual challenge to the existing order and the status quo, it's to be frowned upon. And if you read the editorials in the American press, and if you hear the speeches and statements coming out of the United States, that's what they're all saying. And Samuel Huntington, the American ideologue who came to fame after writing Clash of Civilizations, saying that there was a big, big divide between civilizations. His latest theory is, which he develops, he's not written a book about it, but I'm prepared to bet he will produce a book soon because he's been coming out with this stuff. And it's what he calls the democratic paradox. And the democratic paradox is very simple. It's so simple that it's shameless the way they're saying it. He's saying the big problem with democracy in some parts of the world is that we might get governments which are hostile to US interests elected. He's actually said that. And if you read the comments on Hamas's victory in the Western media, that is what they more or less say. This is a disaster. But this is what the Palestinian people want. On the one hand, you say you invaded Iraq because you wanted democracy. But you didn't permit the Iraqi parties contesting the elections under occupation, not a single one of them, to include in their platform the demand that they wanted the withdrawal of all occupying troops. You said that any party which had that demand would not be allowed to participate. So some of the parties held back but are still in that parliament. In Palestine, you couldn't put any conditions. But immediately they were elected, the British Foreign Office, the State Department, said they have to recognize Israel immediately, and the Egyptians said the same, or we will not deal with them. The EU said, we will not give the new Palestinian government any money at all. To which one of the Hamas people said, the money never reached the people anyway. So that's not such a big threat because it all went to the Palestinian fat cats and their families and the cronies and shopping sprees in Paris and the Gulf and here and there. So we didn't get that much of it, but if it came here, we would use it to construct an infrastructure, a social infrastructure for ordinary Palestinians, schools, clinics, hospitals. But the threat is there. Either you do what we say or we're going to crush you. That is how the West now operates. And that is how the West is seen. And the notion that the European Union was going to be independent of the United States, I mean, that independence went once Baghdad was occupied. The Germans under Schroeder, not just under Merkel. The Germans under Schroeder and France under Chirac congratulated the Americans for a lightning victory. They too didn't know there was going to be a resistance. And the United Nations Security Council legalized the occupation by recognizing the puppet government established by the occupation inside Iraq. This is the same Security Council which, when the Vietnamese moved in to topple a really brutal regime, that of Pol Pot, the same Security Council refused for 12 years to remove Pol Pot's representatives from the United Nations. But the Iraqis were recognized within 4 weeks. So it's this level of double standards that drives people in the Arab world and elsewhere quite crazy. and angry. And as long, I've been arguing now for a long time, the last 4 or 5 years, that as long as the occupations of Palestine and Iraq continue, you will have armed resistance of various sorts, and you will have many embittered, angry young people joining groups like Al-Qaeda. You will encourage the flow of recruits to these organizations. And people in this country should understand that. We've been there before. When was there a massive increase in volunteers for the IRA after Bloody Sunday? No one denies it because it's just a fact. Everyone knows it. British intelligence knows it. The Irish government here, everyone knows it. You behave like that, you kill civilians, and there's anger. And when there's anger, people feel this is all we can do. You know, about 6 months ago, a very incredible, warm human being from Palestine, a psychiatrist who's got a clinic in Gaza, a Palestinian doctor, came to give a lecture in London. I just went and sat at the back to listen to him. It's horrific. Horrific. When he described what daily, everyday conditions were like for the Palestinians. And then he said something which didn't totally surprise me, but it did upset and shock me. He said that mothers, Palestinian mothers, send kids from the ages of 10 to 16 to me virtually every day to talk to them because they're traumatized, they're suffering, they've lost brothers or sisters or families or homes, they can't take the bombing every day, their schools have been bombed. So I speak to them to try and talk them through it. But he said it's really difficult to do that. And he said 90% of these kids, when in an attempt to try and engage them, I say, what do you want to be when you grow up? They say a suicide bomber. And he said, I ask them why. Why? They're saying, it's better than life to sacrifice ourselves so that our children can have a better life one day. That's the level of what goes on. And Western politicians and the Western liberal conscience is totally blind to Palestinian suffering. Every time we see a suicide bomb going on and civilians being killed, it is presented in the media in a completely decontextualized way. So you just see that event, you never see the conditions which have created it for the last so many years. No attempt to explain why. So it appears these people are mad. And if people are mad, then you have to either lock them up in asylums or kill them. That's the way many people look at it. Or more intelligent people don't want to think about it because it's too painful to think about. But the Palestinians are not in a condition to just shut their eyes because they suffer every single day. So, from the point of view of the global crisis, the situation in the Middle East is not a good one. It's not a good one. It's a desperate situation. It's an ugly set of occupations, and I've argued that ugly occupations can never produce a pretty resistance. So people shouldn't get worked up when the resistance fights in the only way it can against what is going on there. The second area where the United States is now really feeling mass anger is in a different continent altogether, Latin America. And here you have a situation where, because of what has been going on in Latin America, it was the first continent to become the laboratory for neoliberal experiments, privatizations, private companies going in, taking the electricity, taking the water, all that. It's also the first continent in which massive social movements have developed against neoliberalism, very concretely and very precisely. And people who are surprised by the victory of Evo Morales in Bolivia recently should remember that 4 years ago there was an uprising in Cochabamba because the country's water had been handed over to an American corporation, Halliburton, I think it was, Cheney's corporation. He was then working for it and not shooting quails. And they went and privatized the water. Prices immediately shot up. And then they did something incredibly arrogant. I mean, just unbelievably arrogant. This corporation said to the poor Bolivians, "It is illegal for you to collect rainwater in receptacles on your roofs when it rains. That is illegal." And the Bolivian government supported that. No wonder there was an insurrection. And they defeated them. In Peru, they were going to sell off the country's electricity to big private corporations. And the peasants in the heartland of Peru in Cusco really rose up in arms, and there was another insurrection. The government went and killed 200 peasants to stop it, but they carried on. And journalists who finally got to the area and interviewed these peasants said, "Why the hell are you fighting? What are you doing?" And they said, "We are fighting because we know that when something is privatized, the price goes up. So for us, the choice is not paying more money or less money. The choice for us is paying more money or reverting to primitive conditions where we have no electricity at all. And we want some electricity in our villages." So they defeated that. And I always say, often when I'm speaking to trade union meetings in Britain, you have that the trade unionists of Europe, who have in many cases allowed neoliberal measures to go through with very little fight back, should actually send delegations to learn from the peasants of Bolivia and Peru what these are like and what they can learn from them. So what we had in Latin America was a whole layer of social movements against this. And do you know when the first social movement was? The first big social movement erupted before the kids, the young people in Seattle, came out onto the streets. It wasn't reported in the Western media, wasn't reported, but you had a giant uprising in Venezuela in 1999, which became known as the Caracazo, because a so-called left social democratic government of Carlos Andrés Pérez pushed through neoliberal measures under the pressure of the World Bank and its structural adjustment programs, and suddenly prices shot up, living standards went down, and the poor in the areas outside Caracas began to rebel. There was a massive uprising, and the army shot 1,000 people dead. 1,000 people, if not more. That's the modest figure. I always prefer giving the lowest estimates, but which are accepted by everyone. But the people on the ground say that at least 2,500 to 3,000 people were killed and buried in mass graves. This was in Caracas, under a social democratic government. And it was against that that a group of radical military officers led by Hugo Chavez protested and tried to change the situation within the army and were arrested. Because Chavez said the army is to defend the country, that's what its task is. Its task is not to shoot down the poor of Venezuela. For that he went to prison. But the fact that a young army officer had stood up and said that left its impact on the consciousness of the Venezuelan poor. And when the Bolivarian movement was launched, a united front of many, many different groups, Chavez won. He's won elections, referendums, constitutional amendments in Venezuela 4 times now by big majorities. And all the old political parties and the oligarchy that backs them have been destroyed, defeated electorally, not by violence, not by armed insurrection, defeated electorally. And what do the United States try and do? They made 3 attempts to try and topple Chavez. 3 attempts. 1 via coup d'etat. They organized the most reactionary generals in Venezuela to organize a coup d'etat. And it's an amazing story what happened. Chavez was arrested, locked up. They said he'd resigned. His daughter was allowed to see him. He told his daughter, ring Fidel in Havana, tell him I haven't resigned, tell the Cubans to go public. She went and rang Fidel. The Cubans broadcasted, Chavez hasn't resigned, he's been arrested, he's under house arrest. That news from Cuba beamed back to Venezuela, created panic. Within 24 hours, they had a corrupt businessman who the army was going to swear in as president in the Miraflores Palace. They were beginning to do it when from the slums of Venezuela and the poor areas, the poor began to march onto the palace, 500,000 people marching. Ordinary soldiers confronted their officers in the barracks and said, what's going on? Are you before the coup? Because if you are, you're alone. They were threatened by a soldiers' insurrection. Inside the palace, a leading general who was a coup maker came out and said to the military band of young soldiers, which plays the national anthem on ceremonial occasions and a bugler who blows the trumpet when a foreign visitor is coming, he went out to them and said, the entire foreign media is here. I'm going to bring the new president out, and I want you to do what you do. You play the national anthem. And these soldiers said, General, what new president? We elected Hugo Chavez. What new president? The general said, I'm just asking you to do as you're told. And they said, General, we will obey orders, but will you answer our question? Who elected this new president? Finally, despairing over instructing the band who refused to play, he went to this 17-year-old kid, fresh from the peasantry, he was just a new recruit, but a very good bugler. And the general walked up to this kid and said, you will play the bugle when I bring the new president out. And the 17-year-old said, excuse me, general, forgive me, but what new president? So the general, this conversation took place 3 times. The 4th time the general said, I'm ordering you. The 17-year-old said, General, you seem very keen that someone should play the bugle. Here, you play. Now, what causes the political consciousness of a young peasant soldier to change? That's the question. That he can defy a general inside an army which is trained and disciplined. What changes political consciousness is the knowledge that they have a political leadership which is acting in the interests of the poor. That's what changes consciousness. And that is the only explanation for the victories of Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, Evo Morales in Bolivia, and possibly a similar candidate who's coming up in Peru. So the face of Latin America is changing because now you actually have in that whole continent 2 alternatives. One is the alternative of Lula in Brazil, who's essentially turned out to be a tropical version of Tony Blair, if you can imagine that. Caving in to all the international institutions, not doing anything for the poor, basically pleasing the Brazilian oligarchy, and embarrassed and shamefaced about it. Backing the American occupation of Haiti, in which the so-called UN occupation of Haiti removes an elected president from power and then kills the poor every day. The first Brazilian general placed in charge of this UN force in Haiti resigned. He resigned because he said, given what we are doing, I don't want to be tried as a war criminal. I can't face my family. I will end up in a court as a war criminal one of these days. So he resigned and went back to Brazil. And back in Brazil, he told people, he said, the people we were being asked to shoot dead on the streets were people like our poor in the streets of Rio de Janeiro and Sao Paulo. That's what they reminded me of. How could I order them shot dead? The second Brazilian general who replaced him also refused to obey orders to shoot the people, and 4 weeks ago committed suicide. That's the extent of the contradictions now in that continent. You never read about this in the great Western media, what is happening in Haiti, what the level of oppression is, what the UN are doing every single day, the so-called UN armies in Haiti, under American pressure. But that is what is going on, and that is what is radicalizing that continent. And the effect this has had, I mean, let me just tell you something else, because I say these things because this is a continent of hope today. The Middle East is a continent of despair. We have to support the Iraqis and the Palestinians, obviously. But it's a grim situation. In Latin America, there are people actually trying to improve social conditions. The second attempt to topple Chavez was a very similar thing they did when they defeated Allende in Chile in the 70s. They organized a middle-class strike, because one thing you have to understand about Venezuela is that the oligarchs have middle-class support and that the class divide is mirrored in a racial divide. So by and large, if you see light-skinned people, it's horrible, but it's true. You know but which side they're on. It's very surprising to see light-skinned people on the big Chavista demonstrations, and if you do, you're nervous that they might be provocateurs. This is common, and most people who've been there will tell you that. So they organized a middle-class strike. And I remember doing a long interview with Chavez, and I said, when did you feel most threatened after that had all been defeated? And he said, you know, I wasn't worried by the coup because I knew the soldiers would back me and the people would never allow this crook to be appointed. But when they stopped the country in its tracks, I was really scared that they might succeed. I remembered what they had done to Allende. And he said, the people who saved us were the Cubans. And I said, how did they do that? He said, we asked for help. And he said, the middle class medical unions had closed down the hospitals. So there was no treatment. People weren't being treated. The teachers had closed down the schools to create a total crisis. He said, the Cubans sent in within 3 weeks 14,500 Cuban doctors who set up clinics in all the poor areas of the country where no doctor had ever set foot. Cuban medicines poured in. He said, of course, we paid for them later, and the doctors. But he said it transformed the situation. Even some supporters of the oligarchs in these poor areas began to say, we've never received such good medical treatment in our lives before. And he said, that saved us. And then he said, teachers began to come in from Cuba, from Argentina, from the teachers' unions elsewhere. Basically, we got the schools working again. And he said, this time when the schools started working, they were more democratically organized. There were committees of parents and the new teachers who sat together and decided what was best for the kids. So it enabled us. He said, the coup enabled me to clean out the army. We got rid of all the reactionary generals, as many as we could lay our hands on. And the strike actually enabled us to begin to make fundamental reforms in the social structure of that state. But that the fact is, if you look at how the media reported this, it's quite shocking, the Western media. And that is one problem we now confront, which is that the Western media, by and large, with some exceptions, has become a central pillar of the whole neoliberal state and the neoliberal global experiment. So you have neoliberalism, which is the Washington Consensus, which walks on two legs, the economic legs through all those institutions and the military leg. And then you have a Western media system which essentially supports this. And everything they write, by and large, is colored by whether it is in the interests of the global neoliberal system or not, which is why you very rarely read stuff about Haiti. Very rarely read stuff about what is actually happening on the ground in Palestine or in Iraq. Al Jazeera, the Arab television channel, has 20 television crews, 20 crews covering Iraq every single day from different parts of the country. Most of the Western media are embedded with the occupying armies. Most of them, not all of them. And so the Arab population does get a different view of what is going on, which is why, in this war of images, the West is very nervous. It wants to have a monopoly of images. And so they bomb Al Jazeera. They bomb them in Afghanistan. They bomb them in Baghdad. They thought about knocking them out completely before the Iraq war. And so the development of the indie media networks and the development of an alternative system of radio stations, etc., which, by the way, is the most advanced in the United States of America, where they feel its need the most. I mean, those of you who know the States a bit will know that Amy Goodman's show, Democracy Now!, is heard by 2.5 million people every single day in the United States. And it's a completely alternative show. But in Europe, we're still a bit behind on that because not all the space has been taken away. There is still some space for alternative voices, though increasingly that space is becoming muted. And less and less on television, it's virtually impossible. And in my book, Rough Music, which is an account of what happened in the recent crisis in Britain, I cite chapter and verse of what the Blair government was doing to the BBC during the run-up to the Iraq war. Downing Street ringing up the Director General of the BBC and saying, why are you reporting that there are 1 million demonstrators on the street? And the Director General of the BBC, Greg Dyke, having to tell Alistair Campbell, this sort of debased PR boy who was Blair's deputy, having to tell him because that's what it is. And Campbell saying, did you go and count them? At which point Dyke lost his temper and said, Alistair, this is the figure we're getting from Scotland Yard. The demonstrators are claiming 1.5 million at this point. So who should we support, Scotland Yard or not? But this extent of interference and then the sad suicide or death of Dr. Kelly. And finally, what does Blair do? He removes the chairman and the director general of the BBC shamelessly and publicly. They're sacked. Two total placemen, total New Labour guys, but who weren't prepared to go all the way. And that attack on the BBC is mimicked in Australia by the ABC. Another country I visit a lot. So what you essentially see is a closing of ranks. And this is now happening increasingly in Western Europe as well. I don't, read the Irish press or watch the Irish television regularly, but it wouldn't surprise me if the situation was more or less the same here. I stand to be corrected. This is the pattern of mediatic and media politics, and it is linked to the neoliberal global system. So this is the world we confront, and it's a world which institutionalizes apathy, which encourages people to be apolitical. It encourages a sort of empty consumerism. It prioritizes money over any other value. And so it's easy in this world to become distracted and to think that there's absolutely nothing we can do. But this is actually now leading to a big crisis in the functioning of democracy itself. Blair was elected last time with the lowest vote of any government, any European government in electoral history. For the last two British general elections, a majority of young people from the ages of 18 and 26 did not vote. In the United States, we know what the figure is anyway. The poor don't bother to vote and the rich buy the elections. I mean, that's a reality. So what we see basically happening in the Western world is a hollowing out of democracy, where democracy is being used to try and achieve some changes in the Middle East or in Latin America, as I pointed out. That democracy is not acceptable to the West. When they talk about democracy, they mean our style of democracy. Not too many differences, not too many divergences. In other words, democracy, as we used to know it, has become an ideology called democratism. That's all it is now, increasingly so. And this means that we need citizens to be active. We need people like you to be active. We need organizations like this and others to exist. We need to get away from that world in which many people, you know, most people have got away from it, the young especially, but the world of, you know, cultivating one's own patch and thinking that that's what's important, and learning to work together, learning to build alliances. That is the lesson which we get now from the continent which is ahead, which is the Latin American continent. I'll stop there so you can ask some questions.